Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. So happy to have you here with us. Happy Easter as the Easter season continues. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and it remains open forum. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, about what Catholic people believe, what we do, and why we believe and do the things that we do believe and do. Wow, that got really complicated there at the end. Your call is welcome. 888-318-7884. Took a wrong turn there. 888-31-TRUTH if you prefer the spelled version of it. 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour is Father John Trigilio. You know Father John Trigilio from his many endeavors in Catholic media. He is you're a native of Erie, Pennsylvania, right, Father?
Yes, where they had the 8 feet of snow for Christmas this year.
Did they really?
Yes, it was 4 feet was Christmas Eve and then another 3 feet Christmas Day.
Wow, I had no idea. I'm glad you all survived. But are you still? You're not still in Erie though. You're in Harrisburg.
No. I'm a priest of the Harrisburg Diocese now, and yep. We got a lot less.
people should also know that Father Trigilio has a doctorate in medieval philosophy and as a doctor of theology in biblical studies. He's also the author of. I love the fact that you're the author of all these dummies books: Catholicism for Dummies, Women in the Bible for Dummies, John Paul II for Dummies, Saints for Dummies. You also wrote the Everything Bible book and the Catholicism Answer book. Anyways, Father John Trigilio, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Now, for a priest, as the cycle of a priest's life goes, are these days and weeks after Easter a little bit calmer? Like, do you get some rest? Do you catch up on your sleep or what happens?
Well, normally, yes. When you're a parish priest, it's a little downtime, but I also work 3 days a week at the seminary as the director of pastoral formation. So as soon as we got back from Easter vacation, all the vocation directors wanted to meet, and we had meetings to make sure the guys get evaluated before they leave the seminary. So they ramped up right after the parish life kind of had a little lull. So it you bounce right back.
I guess are you one of those I'll rest when I'm dead kind of guys?
I don't know. I'll be like Father Levis, and I think he hasn't rested yet, and he's been passed away for a couple of years.
I have known priests like that. 888-318-7884, the number again, if you would like to talk with Father Trigilio. Father, we have every single line full at the moment. Shall we work our way through them? All right.
Okay.
Let's go to Paul in Houston, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Paul, your question for Father Trigilio.
Hello, Father. Okay.
Hello.
My question is, what's the equivalent to the Protestant question, are you saved and are you born again? I'm thinking we're saved at baptism and we're born again every time we walk out of that confessional booth. What's your thinking on that?
Yes, I would say that's correct, but I would also include we are born again first at baptism because it is a spiritual regeneration. But yes, we are saved at the moment of baptism, and the distinction I like to make is that, Jesus offers us salvation at baptism, but obviously you and I need to all continually cooperate with it, and when you and I commit a mortal sin, you know, that kills the life of grace. That's why, as you point out, when you go to confession, you have your mortal sins removed. Sanctifying grace is restored, and you're brought back to life again. That's why there was the tradition of having the confessional sort of as a dark little box, because you went in there like a tomb, and you come out like Lazarus into the light now that you've been forgiven.
Okay. Thank you. That's it.
Oh, good. Very good. Thanks, Paul. Thanks for that question. Did a little bit of the show music go out during that, Nick? Oh, a little bit? Okay.
Yes, just a wee bit.
I thought Paul might have won a prize or something with with that question.
Send him one anyway.
Yeah, right. I should have got his address and sent him a prize. He probably thought he won, too. Oh, we go back to Texas. Danny in San Antonio, Texas, also listening on Guadalupe Radio. Danny, you are on with Father John Trujillo.
Hi, Cy and Father. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Happy Easter.
Good. Hey, thank you. Happy Easter to you. Hey, just to let you know, I gave up sports talk radio and political radio for Lent, and thanks to you guys, I'm never going back. You guys are awesome. Thanks for all that you do.
Thank you, Danny. That's really nice. Thanks for calling. Call again sometime. I just want to leave it right there.
No.
I'm just kidding.
No, I got a burning question.
Okay, go ahead, Danny.
All right. So my burning question, about a week ago, my wife came to me and said and I apologize if I get this wrong, but she said that she was listening to Scott Hahn, and he had said that marriage should mirror or resemble the gospel. And that has thrown me for a loop. Mm.
In what way?
Well, I guess I don't. I look at the gospels as, you know, the telling of the story and, you know, we've been married for 18 years. We have four beautiful children, one who's in the car with me right now.
Great.
So we're kind of in a little, not a lull, but a rough patch in our marriage. But she asked me how I thought our marriage could mirror the gospels.
Oh, okay. Well, not to scare you in any way, but you know, Jesus does say, take up your cross daily. And, you know, part of marriage is that, you know, it is a cross, but so is, you know, my vocation to the priesthood. Every vocation that God gives, whether it's to the married life, to religious life, to priesthood or whatever, you know, there is the aspect of the cross, but there's also the resurrection. There's joy and there's sorrow. And when you look at the life of say, the Blessed Virgin Mary and St. Joseph, you know, they lived as husband and wife, although they, you know, didn't have any conjugal relations. They were married in the eyes of God. They lived as husband and wife. And they had good days and bad days, not necessarily because, you know, obviously there was no sin committed, yet there were struggles, like when they had to flee into Egypt, when Jesus was missing for 3 days. So married couples go through bumps in the road, and there's struggles, just as there are in the religious vocation or priesthood. But I think you can say marriage is like a gospel, is that the purpose of the gospel is to tell the good news. And a husband and wife are to reflect the light, the love that Jesus has for his bride, the church. And, you know, obviously the groom is Jesus, is perfect, but the bride, you know, it's in essence a spotless bride, but you and I as individual members, you know, we're short of the mark many times. So as I say to couples that are getting married, when I do their ceremony, there is no such thing as a perfect marriage except the marriage between Christ and his church. But the imperfect marriages are like imperfect friendships here on earth. They're worth struggling for. They're worth keep trying, never give up. And that's the key, is to never give up on each other, never give up on your marriage.
Danny.
Those are the words I was looking for. I just couldn't find the words, so I thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you very, very much for the call and for your kind words. 888-318-7884 is the number. Father John Trujillo is our guest, and it's open forum. Any question you have about the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church is welcome. We'll take up more of those questions right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live.
Over the years, we have heard thousands of stories of how the ministry of Catholic Answers and Catholic Answers Live has changed lives all over the world. Do you have such a story? We'd love to hear how Catholic Answers has changed your life. Send your story to us today. Email us at mystory@catholic.com, or you can call 619-387-7200 to make an audio recording of your story.
Pope Francis said, "All of us are called to mature in our work as evangelizers. We want to have better training, a deepening love, and a clearer witness to the gospel. St. Paul Street Evangelization's online School of Evangelization will equip you with the tools you need to be an effective evangelist. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you're unable to give, we'll set you up for free. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
God helps those who help themselves. Preach the gospel always. When necessary, use words. We all hear sayings like these, and we assume they come from the Bible, the saints, or famous Christian writers. Nobody can seem to place their origin, but by sheer repetition, they've acquired a halo of truth. In my new book, What the Saints Never Said, I look at over 40 of these well-known sayings and track them back to their original sources. You'll be surprised at what I found. Some are close to what was really said. Many were misattributed or twisted beyond their original meaning, and more than a few of these sayings were simply made up. I hope by setting the record straight, I can make you aware of the theological errors that can lead us away from the faith and offer you authentic quotes from scripture, saints, and scholars that will draw you closer to our faith. Get your copy of What the Saints Never Said by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum today. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Father John Trigilio, and our topic is whatever is on your mind about the Catholic Church. Again, 888-318-7884, the number. Let's go to Juan in Monterey, California, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Juan, thanks for downloading the app, and your question for Father Trigilio.
Hi, Father.
How you doing?
Good, 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 Father. I just want to say I love Catholic Answers. You guys rock. So my question is, someone told me, a friend told me that Jesus was Jewish, and he said, and I was just thinking, if Jesus was Jewish, does that mean the Jewish religion was around longer than Catholic religion?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Judaism begins with, obviously, the covenant made with Abraham, and Jesus was born into the Jewish faith. That's why he functioned as a rabbi, and he is, you know, his lineage goes back, obviously, to King David, and all the way back further than that. In fact, one of the lineages we have in the Gospels, he goes back to Abraham, and the other one traces him all the way back to Adam, from Adam and Eve. So Judaism has been around the longest. It's the one that God himself started, but from Judaism comes the Christianity, and we firmly believe that Jesus, who again was brought up and raised as a Jew, not only saved all of mankind as the Messiah. So he came for all men and women, and so the new covenant, the old covenant was with God and the chosen people. The new covenant is between Jesus Christ and all of humanity, and so then Christ founds the Catholic Church and builds it upon the Rock of Peter. So yes, Judaism chronologically predates the Catholic Church, and we see ourselves as the fulfillment of that first covenant, and now it is we're living in the new or second covenant.
Juan?
Okay, so does that mean like that Jewish religion is like more accurate than Christianity?
No, it's just that it came first. It predated it in the sense that obviously the first covenant, that's why we have in the Bible, we have the Old Covenant, the Old Testament, and the New Testament. And the Old Testament or the Old Covenant was between God and Abraham and the chosen people. And then Jesus comes and in a sense fulfills that covenant and now opens a new one with the whole human race. And so he's the savior and redeemer of everyone, not just the chosen people. So he makes salvation possible to everyone.
Okay. That was great. Thank you for that, Father. Thank you.
Juan, those are really good questions, and I'm very happy you asked them, because a lot of times we don't get a chance to get into those things. So please call anytime, Juan. If you got a question, we'll do our very best to answer it. Thanks. Again, 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Let's go to Jake in Rochester, Minnesota, listening on EWTN. Jake, your question for Father John Trigilio.
Yeah, so I was wondering, are the devotions like doing the rosary and the Divine Mercy and all of them a must-have to be a Catholic?
Well, I wouldn't use the phrase must-have. Because the church makes a distinction between sacraments, like the seven sacraments, which are necessary for salvation. So baptism obviously is, and penance and Eucharist and all the seven sacraments. Sacramentals, as the catechism defines it, are those things which were not instituted by Christ, but come to us from the church, from tradition. And so the rosary, Divine Mercy, the scapular, anything that's external to what Christ himself instituted, namely the sacraments, are things which are, if you want to use the terminology, optional, but they're highly encouraged because they have the church's full endorsement, and you're highly encouraged to use them. But it's like private revelation. You can take it or leave it. You do not have to believe, for instance, that Mary appeared in Lourdes or Fatima. But many people like myself do believe that. But if you chose not to believe it because it's private revelation, you're not a bad Catholic. But you have to believe that, you know, the books of the Bible are divinely inspired, that it is revealed word of God, you know, that you go from Genesis all the way to the book of Revelation. That's not up for grabs. That you have to accept, just like we have to accept the seven sacraments, that which is, you know, taught infallibly by the church. But things like Divine Mercy and the Rosary, the sacramentals, we make that distinction. So, yeah, they're optional, but it's like vitamins. You know, they're very good for you, and they'll help you along the way.
Okay, Jake.
Okay. Yep.
Thank you. Thanks so much for that question, Jake. We are moving right along today, Father. Let's go to Marcia in Colorado Springs, Colorado, listening to EWTN on Sirius XM satellite radio. Marcia, your question for Father John Trigilio.
Well, my question's about Abraham. And before God made his covenant with him, what was his religion?
Well, that's a good question. You know, that
that is a good question.
I must say, I've never even been asked that in CCD. Usually the third grade CCD kids have good questions like that. Technically, Abraham did not have any particular religion, but he did believe in God, because the belief in God is something that is part of reason. That's why even the pagan Romans and Greeks, even when they were at their sort of best behavior, you know, conjectured that there must be a supreme being. And obviously, when God speaks to Abraham and establishes a covenant, Abraham is not sort of blown over, oh my goodness, who's this, who's talking to me, type of thing. It's just that since the fall of Adam and Eve, there was not a direct communication between God and the human race until Abraham comes and now establishes this new covenant. Yet God does speak in a sense, or communicates, say, with Noah and before he builds the ark. But there's not a formalized religion per se. Judaism, or the Hebrew religion, is formally established with Abraham, and then even more so with Moses, when the God precisely tells them how to worship him, not just the Seder meal and the Passover feast, but even how to worship God in the weekly Sabbath celebration. So the roots of Judaism are there from going back to Adam and Eve, but the formalized religion, we say, that's why we call ourselves sons and daughters of Abraham. We trace ourselves back to that particular moment.
Marcia?
Okay, that sounds great. I heard somebody say that Abraham wasn't Jewish, because Jewish refers to the tribe of Judah, and I got confused about all that.
Oh, well, you know, that's there are distinct, I mean, technically speaking, the word Jews are not used until a little bit later. They're called Hebrews first. So, yeah, I mean, but interchangeably now today, when you speak to a Jewish person, you know, they say, yes, I'm a Jew, and they trace themselves back to Abraham. And, you know, we even but that's looking at it through our lives in 2018. But if you were to go back centuries and centuries back to the pre-Christian era, yeah, they would have made a distinction that they would not have seen themselves as Jews first. They would have considered themselves Hebrews.
Marcia, thanks very, very much. Appreciate that call. Father, folks sometimes type in questions for us on Facebook and YouTube. And Jeff on Facebook wants to know, and I'm with Jeff, I want to know this too. What happened to St. Joseph's body?
Ah, oh, that's the $64,000 question.
Ah, who gets the $64,000? Me or Jeff?
I'll tell you, we really don't know, because he did die, and that's why he's the patron saint of a happy death. We just have no idea where his body is laid. And when St. Helena, in the 4th century, after Constantine, her son, legalized Christianity in 313 with the Edict of Milan, she went to the Holy Land and she found the Holy Sepulchre, and that's where, you know, they built the shrine. So they went to the Holy Land and found all these spots where Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and where he died on Calvary, and where he rose from the dead. But they never – I don't know if they didn't look for it, or they never found the tomb of St. Joseph. That's not to say that someone may not find it at some particular point. If they find it, they're definitely going to find bones in there, because the only one who was assumed into heaven was the Blessed Virgin Mary. So the only people who have their body intact up in heaven is Jesus and his mother. So Joseph is somewhere to be found. Likewise, Joseph from the Old Testament, you know, there's a scene where, if you remember in the movie The Ten Commandments, they process the bones of Joseph when they left Egypt in the Exodus, because remember Joseph had died in Egypt, you know, after he had been found friendly with, or the Pharaoh had shown favor to him. But when they were when they left Egypt, they supposedly brought the bones of Joseph with them. We don't know where the tomb of where those bones are either. So, I mean, somebody could find Joseph of the Old Testament. They could find Saint Joseph. It would certainly be an archaeological wonder if they could do that. So I'm telling those archaeologists out there, keep looking.
Get to work. Yeah. Well, it wouldn't it be wonderful to find where Joseph is buried? But it would be hard to, like, even if it said Joseph, say it said Joseph, father of Jesus, or something like that. It would be hard, because those are common names, right?
Well, yes. Plus, they would never have called him father of Jesus.
Oh, I see.
Because first of all, I mean, as Christians, we believe he's the foster father of Jesus, but he died, we believe, before Jesus began his public ministry.
Right.
So Jesus was always referred to as, you know, aren't you the carpenter's son? Aren't you the son of Joseph? So his notoriety did not come about until the wedding feast of Cana, and Joseph is probably already gone by then. So if they find Joseph, they'll just find the name Joseph, and I doubt they would put even that his wife's name was Mary. Now, later Christians may have, if they knew where he was buried, may have added that. But when he died, he was just merely known as Joseph of Nazareth.
Indeed. So, but they are finding new stuff all the time, because I think just recently they found King Herod's tomb. Isn't that right?
Yes. But, you know, obviously King Herod's going to have the means and the to get buried in a nice place. But, yeah, they could – because, you know what, when you go to Rome, especially in the catacombs, they are built upon each other. So if you keep digging and digging, it's more than likely at some point in the Holy Land they're going to excavate and find people as going back to the time of Joseph himself, because that's 2,000 years ago. But the climate, the atmosphere, the political stuff that's been going on in that area of the world for centuries doesn't make it that conducive, unless you're like a pharaoh where you're buried in a pyramid and nobody disturbs your resting place. But I would say, I would hope in my lifetime they do find the relics of St. Joseph, because that would be really, really something spectacular.
Yeah, it was just in the 20th century that they found the bones of St. Peter. Those were lost for all those centuries.
Yes, they were. In fact, it was an earthquake in Rome in the 50s that Pope Pius XII authorized them to go and sort of fix things up. And then they found clues that maybe St. Peter was actually buried there. Tradition had always been that he was there, but archaeologists were sort of doubtful. They said, well, maybe he is, maybe he isn't. And then that earthquake moved stuff around, and then they actually found his bones in 1950 after he had been there for almost 2,000 years.
Yeah, so it's exciting to think that how much is still out there left to be found. Do we have the bones of St. Paul or no?
St. Paul's remains, I believe they have – I don't think they have his bones per se. They might have something.
Okay.
Because Peter being the Bishop of Rome, and now it's obvious that, you know, St. Peter and Paul, we believe, were martyred around the same time or time frame because of,
right.
But Paul, because he was a Roman citizen, I don't know what they may have done something else with his body.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Father John Trujillo is our guest. It is open forum. I realize I have been monopolizing Father for a few minutes, but we'll get right back to calls when we come back after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our fifth annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there.
We've had a wonderful time going home all enthused.
Every time we come here, it's just an incredible experience.
Normally, you'd have to root through a dozen different books to get half the stuff I've learned here.
These guys are so amazing. I always get so much, learn so much. I've already signed up for next year.
Join us this September 27th to the 30th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. All of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and special keynote speaker, Raymond Leo Cardinal Burke.
I enjoy the atmosphere and the friendliness of the people. I'm having a great time.
I love it. I love it. I'm so glad I came here.
I've just learned so much. You know, I've been a Catholic all my life. It's just been so wonderful.
I love it. I want to come back every year.
What does the Church actually teach about same-sex attraction? If God created certain people gay, how can we say that it's sinful for them to live that way? Why should we listen to the Old Testament's condemnation of homosexuality when Jesus never said anything about it? In 20 Answers Homosexuality, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, providing a faithful look at what the Bible, the Church, the natural law, and science have to say about same-sex attraction, and how to respond with undiluted truth and compassionate love. 20 Answers Homosexuality is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting series from Catholic Answers Press.
I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio with Matthew Bunsen. Join us every week as we talk with the Register's expert writers and editors about the news you need to know and offer authentic Catholic insights on the important stories that impact your life. Register Radio, every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern and Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.
That is what we call the groovy music. We wait all week for that groovy music, and we enjoy it. It's fleeting, but that's part of what makes it precious. Thanks for the groovy music, Nick. Welcome back. It's Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. Our guest is Father John Trujillo. And you know what? I think Father is often here on Thursday. I think that's your main thing, right? You come on a Thursday, so you get the groovy
Thursday
music.
Thursday is my day, yes.
Yeah, so you're like, that's kind of unfair. You're getting the groovy music more than anyone else.
Well, what's also interesting is that I'm also on our local radio station on Thursdays as well. So Thursday's my day.
I guess so. That's your radio day, huh?
Yes.
What day is TV day for you, or how do you do that?
TV day, EWTN, they have us Saturday night at 11 p.m. Eastern time.
No, but so when are you?
That's not live. That's taped.
Yeah. So when are you in the studio doing it?
We go down once a year and tape 13 episodes.
Oh, I gotcha. I see.
Yeah. Oh, but I'm hoping they move us to a better time because 11 o'clock, all these people are calling me, especially little old ladies from Pasadena, and are saying it's too late.
Well, in Pasadena, it's not 11 o'clock. In Pasadena, it's 8 o'clock. So the little old ladies have a cup of coffee, ladies, because
they put a bed early out there, yeah, I heard.
But they drive fast. 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Let's go now to Philip in Fairfield, Connecticut. Philip, you are on with Father John Trujillo.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for taking my call. This is a phenomenal program.
Thank you.
And thanks again for your time and sharing your knowledge. My question pertains, and I'm so sorry, I originally had one question, but is it okay? I actually have two questions, and I'll be very brief.
Of course, yes.
Okay, question number one. In Genesis, there's a passage where God states that humankind was going to be limited to 120 years. However, I don't quite recall if it was before or after the flood, but we know that Noah and his sons, Ham, Shem, Japheth, lived beyond that, as well as succeeding generations as well. So is that literal or is that just figurative speech? Because I've had some discussions with a couple of coworkers not so long ago where one said, oh, within this lifetime or the next generation, we're going to be able to see humankind surpass 150 years. I said, that's impossible. Well, it's because of there's a direct statement from God, Yahweh himself, that he states humankind would be limited to 120 years, and that's irrefutable, I would like to think. So that's question number one.
All right. Let's do them one at a time so we don't get confused. Go ahead. Father, will you address that?
Yes. I don't think necessarily it's limited to that the life is only going to be up to 120. You can interpret it one of two ways. One, you interpret it literally that it's going to be at least 120. So that's the minimum. Or you could interpret it allegorically or metaphorically, just as, when Jesus says, when your right eye causes you to sin, cut it out. A lot of times in the scriptures, they use numbers in a very figurative sense. So that when Peter says, how many times must I forgive my brother? Seven times. Jesus says, no, not seven times. I tell you 70 times, seven times, which is a way of saying more than you can count. It's not saying that Peter was slow in math class, but there are a lot of figures of speech. So you can look at it either way, but I would not say that in either context, the 120 years is meaning that mankind can only live to that amount and no more.
I see. Because I didn't see from reading it. It really begins with Moses, where he died at 120.
Yes, but at no point thereafter. I don't think it says that it's 120 alone or by itself. And again, you have to go to the actual Hebrew text, and I don't think it makes it exclusive. It's not an exclusive number. Is what I'm saying is that 120 could be interpreted as the minimum amount, or it can be considered a figurative. But I don't think it means it's an exclusive number that you could only get to 120 and no higher.
Interesting. Okay.
Second question, great. Philip.
Now, the novena for Pentecost, does it begin 9 days before? I was told that it begins on the 4th of May.
It depends on when it occurs every year. Because Easter changes, so that 50 days after Easter is when we celebrate Pentecost, and the novena would be 9 days prior to that. So each calendar year, the novena for Pentecost is going to change. But as long as you get 9 days in before the actual celebration, That's how, at least that's how the church interprets a novena.
And Pentecost is on May 20th this year is Pentecost. So I don't, you'll have to do the math, though. I have a hard, fast rule, no math on the radio. So you figure out 9 days before the 20th, and you can do it. Thanks, Philip, very much for that call. Let's go to Lily in Portland, Oregon, watching on YouTube. Lily, you are on with Father John Trigilio.
Hello. Thank you for taking my question. I was wondering, because I know that it's never permitted to formally cooperate with evil, and that material cooperation is only permitted under certain circumstances. And so it seems really hard to avoid material cooperation. So I'm kind of wondering, could you help me understand that better?
Sure. That's a very good question, because a lot of people, unfortunately, don't even ask that. Formal cooperation is when you willingly assent to the evil that's being done. Material cooperation is when you're only providing the means for that evil to be done, but you're internally not assenting to it. It's still not permitted to – obviously, if a terrorist asks you for materials to build a bomb and you know what he's going to do with it, you're providing material cooperation, although it's not formal because you're against it, but you're materially providing it. It's still wrong. What is allowed is not – we call proximate, which is very close, but we call remote material cooperation in evil. And that's in which it's more than one, a couple of times removed. So for instance, you run a sporting goods store and somebody buys a weapon from you, but you have they don't tell you what they're going to do with it. You think they're going to go hunting and they commit a crime with that, or they go buy fertilizer and don't tell you they're going to build a bomb. You're not culpable of a material cooperation in evil because, as far as you know, there was no crime that was going to be committed. And so your culpability in terms of remote material cooperation depends on how far removed are you from the incident and what do you know is going to be done with those material things?
Would you mind if I gave an example just to ask?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what if you had a construction company where they were asked to build a store where they knew that, like a grocery store, so where a lot of good things would be sold, but some immoral things like contraceptives would also be sold. Would that be immoral mm-hmm. for them to build the grocery store?
No, it would not be immoral to build a grocery store because the primary purpose of the store is to provide something that's neutral or beneficial. The fact that they do sell things that are not acceptable in the eyes of the church, that's considered a remote material cooperation. If it was to build, say, an abortion clinic, then you'd have to say no. If you knew that that's what the building was going to be, you'd have to say no to the contract. But if you're building a building where something may happen later on, or it's a store where there may be some things sold that are not totally acceptable, that's considered a remote material cooperation. So the more imminent you are, and the question is, how dependent are they for your material sustenance? If you run a lumber store and you sell wood and somebody builds something with it, you know, again, if they build something that's used to inflict evil upon people and you have no idea they're going to do that, or you're the only store in town, you know, again, there's a lot of things you need to punch into the equation as well, is how dependent are they upon you to accomplish this task, and what do you know they're going to do with what they're going to do, and how far, say, removed are you from in terms of moral culpability. So it's something that you may need to think about and talk to, obviously, someone's spiritual director or confessor. If you're in a position, it's your decision to make, do we accept this contract or not? It's like when people invest in the stock market, you know, they should look into what companies they're investing are doing with. But nowadays, there's so many companies that are owned by a company that's owned by another company, you know, it becomes so remote that you'd have to say, well, either I invest in nothing, or, you know, everybody's culpable.
Okay, Lily.
Thank you so much. That helps a lot.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Lily, for the call. This is one of the things about Catholic moral teaching that impresses me, but it's very difficult sometimes for people to grasp, is that there's not a one-size-fits-all answer. We have to work our way through these things to find out how remote is the cooperation or how proximate, and often we need help to do that.
Oh, absolutely. It's like when somebody asks for a ride, whether you're a taxi cab driver, Uber driver, or just a private citizen, if you don't know where they're going or what they're going to do, where they're taking them to, there's no problem. However, you may be, in not knowing, taking someone to meet another person to conspire to commit a crime or grave sin, where you might have some moral constraints on, is if you're in the business of taking people privately, you say, well, I'm not taking them to places that I know are immoral. You'd have to be the owner of the company to be able to say that.
Oh, I see. I see what you're saying. Again, it's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Father John Trigilio is our guest. It's open forum. Lots more questions coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Can you trust the basis of the Christian faith? The Christian faith is under constant attack today in numerous ways, but the attack that does the most damage is the one that asks a deceptively simple question. What if your faith is based on a myth? The skeptics come with arguments to cast doubt in numerous ways, often attacking the reliability of the New Testament and the Gospels. And the sad news is that most people don't know how to answer these charges. The good news is that there are answers to each and every one of them. Good, solid answers. That's why Catholic Answers Studios has just released Jimmy Akin's new DVD, The Dawn of Christian History. With his characteristic wit and passion as a master storyteller, Jimmy takes you through an exciting detective story that reveals how history supports the Christian faith. Order your copy of The Dawn of Christian History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Do you enjoy tedious lectures full of facts you'll never use? We didn't think so. That's why we're launching the Council of Trent, Trent Horn's engaging new podcast. Every week, you'll get lively lessons in Catholic teaching, as well as a new conversation roadmap that will help you share your Catholic faith with anyone, anytime, anywhere. Visit TrentHornPodcast.com now to find out how you can subscribe to this exciting new podcast.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Looking for an on-fire Catholic speaker for your event? Catholic Answers speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Time is flying. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum today. Father John Trigilio is our guest, and there are so many questions. I'm just going to try to move through them as quickly as I can. So please excuse me if it seems like I'm being short and moving fast, but that we're going to try to get as many questions as we can before the show has to end. Timothy in Kerrville, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Your question for Father.
I had two questions, if I could. But anyways, I'll just get to the first one. I work at a very busy place, and I run into a lot of people. And whenever I run into a Jehovah's Witness, they always try to get me interested. I never am. But one of them was telling me that Christ didn't die on a cross. And I said, where did you hear that? She says, well, the ancient word stauros means stake. It never means two pieces of wood, and he died on a stake, on an standing straight up stick, not a cross. And I was just wondering if did he die on a cross? Is that true, or is that word
okay?
Ancient Greek stars.
Father.
I've seen that argument before, and the solution is that when you look at the text of the New Testament, and obviously the New Testament was written first in Greek, then translated into Latin, and then later on into our modern languages. The word stauros doesn't appear in the Greek text. There is a Greek word stauros that means stake, But there's the Latin word crux, which means cross. And the Romans were famous for their crucifixions. And they just didn't put people on stakes. They actually put them on crosses. And, you know, before the time of Jesus, the Romans still were very prolific. And, I mean, remember the it was the Spartacus, the slave that tried to have the uprising. They put crucifixes all – they crucified all the slaves on the Appian Way all the way to the city of Rome. To tell the slaves never to do this again, and they didn't. So the Roman custom of crucifixion is very much, you know, what we're used to seeing today in our religious art of Jesus, you know, having the two beams. Now, there is some controversy, or I should say, discussion on, you know, did he carry the whole cross while he was going up to Calvary? Because some archaeologists or scholars are saying, no, he just carried the one beam, and then they fastened it to the other one. But no matter what happened on the way, once he got to Calvary, he was put on the cross, which was a vertical and a horizontal beam.
Okay, Timothy?
Yes.
Go ahead real quick with your second question.
I was just in my own personal – I was still trying to get a hold of where in the Old Testament where's paradise, Hades, and then hell, and then heaven, and then purgatory. I was trying to get that in order correctly. I guess before he died, and then after. Real quick. I mean, I'm confused about Hades and I guess paradise.
Fair enough.
Okay, well, I mean, it is can be confusing because the word paradise is often referred to as to where Adam and Eve dwelt in the Garden of Paradise, which was not technically heaven yet. Heaven is the place where if you see God face to face, and once you're in heaven, you can never get out. The fact that Adam and Eve sinned and were expelled from paradise tells us that, strictly speaking, paradise was not heaven. It was a place just before one gets to heaven. Hades is a Greek word for hell, and often they refer to it as the hell of the dead, where the dead people would go until Jesus came and, you know, opened the gates of heaven that had been closed by the sin of Adam and Eve. In Christian parlance, we reserve the word hell now for the hell of the damned. Those are the souls who go there that are where the demons live, and that's separate from the hell of the dead, or sometimes Hades, which referred to where Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the people in the Old Testament went to before they could get to heaven. They had to wait for Jesus to come and redeem them. Purgatory is a place that the church refers to as the state, not necessarily a place, the state of cleansing, from the word purgatus, meaning to wash or clean. That's where the souls are prepared to go to heaven. It's Dante Alighieri in his Divine Comedy that refers to the three different levels of Paradiso, which is Italian for heaven, and then you got Inferno, which is Italian for hell, and Purgatorio, which is Italian for purgatory. So often his terminology is what people misinterpret as Catholic dogma, and it was not dogma. It was a poem written by him that incorporated Catholic teaching. But he described purgatory as sort of like the suburb of hell. And I think Father Benedict Rochelle of Happy Memory said, if you're going to use that kind of analogy, it's better to think of purgatory as the outskirts of heaven. You're close enough to hear everything and that, but you're not quite there yet. But it's not a place of punishment. It's a place of cleansing.
Timothy, thanks very much. As I said, lots of calls to get to. I'm going to go as quickly as I can. So we will now to Charbel in Buffalo, New York. Charbel, you are on with Father John Trigilio. Your question, please.
Hello, Father Trigilio.
Hello.
Hello, yes. I have a question about the particular judgment.
Okay.
So my question is, I've been thinking about it, and it's I've been fearing it. I mean, like, how should Christians, like, consider or regard the particular judgment? I'm talking about, like, those who are striving for heaven, even though, like, we're sinful and we're imperfect.
Yes.
How do you, I mean, that's the thing. What I'm struggling with is, like, facing Jesus after, like, you know, everyone's going to face him in judgment, but how do I not fear it?
Okay, well, that's a good – I mean, you should have reverential fear, okay, but not terrified fear. Reverential fear is like the fear you have of fire. You don't want to get burned, but we still use it to cook and clean in that. Likewise, we should have reverential fear for particular judgment, but not terrified fear. And that simply means that I know it's going to happen. I try to prepare myself for it as much as possible, meaning that I stay in the state of grace as much and as long as possible. And when, God forbid, I am in mortal sin, I go to confession as soon as possible, because you never know the day nor the hour. So if I'm ready any day of the week, if that's the day God calls me for particular judgment, I'll be ready, okay? And that merely means that I'm in the state of grace. I don't have a mortal sin on my soul, and it doesn't mean that I have not made mistakes. It doesn't mean that I've not had sins in the past, but that I've been reconciled. If I can go to bed every night with a clear conscience, that's a good thing, but you need to make a good examination of conscience, a good act of contrition, go to confession regularly, go to Mass, and receive the sacraments. And if you live a good, virtuous life, then you don't have much to fear. It's those people who dip their toe, so to speak, in religious and spiritual life that have more to worry about, or people who don't, evaluate their moral life. Am I doing things, in accord with God's will? Am I being a good person? If they're not asking themselves that question, it's like a person who never goes to the doctor. Guess what? When the day you do go, you may find out there's a lot going on in you that's not good.
Charbel, thank you. Let's move to Barry in Dayton, Ohio, listening on EWTN. Barry, your question for Father John Trujillo.
Thank you for taking my call. A quick question. It's a long story, but a quick question. I started in RCIA at a local church, and for a number of different reasons, I had to drop out. I've gone back to the church, and I feel like I've been rebuffed or ignored by the presiding pastor. He's a father over three local Catholic churches, and I don't know how to get acquainted again with the church since he's ignoring me. I go to Mass on Saturdays or Sundays, and I'll sit in the front row. I'll make a gesture toward him and look the other way. He won't acknowledge me. So I'm at a loss what to do.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. And I'm not going to make any excuses for any of my colleagues who, if they're acting improperly, then shame on them. But I don't know what's going on there. But I would say to you, go to another Catholic church, find a church, a Catholic church where the priest or deacon or the parochial vicar will work with you. It's sorry that you can't go to the one you started off with, but I know many priests are not ordained in the diocese that they started in, myself included. So God calls us to different places, and maybe that's what God's doing with you. He's asking you to come into the church, but into a different parish. But don't limit your entrance into the church merely because of that particular priest or that particular parish. It's too important and it's too valuable to you to do that.
Barry?
Yes.
How's that?
That's fine. I feel like time is limited for me. I'm not a young pup anymore, and I was baptized in the Catholic Church and kind of went around the block these years and felt called back to this particular church to find that three in this particular area.
Well, let me ask Father real quick, Barry. If Barry's been baptized a Catholic, what does he have to do to receive communion?
All he needs to do is make a good confession. Unless he's formally left the church and joined another religion, then he would have to make a profession of faith. Now, if he's ever been confirmed, it'd probably be good to have him prepare for confirmation. But again, I put it this way, I don't want to be too blunt, but if you were dying and you needed a doctor, and the nearby hospital, the doctor there wasn't too nice or friendly, you have to say to yourself, either I go to another hospital or I put up with his nonsense. And if he doesn't let you into the, if he doesn't look at you the right way, the thing is, it's more important that you get the sacraments. And although you may not be a spring chicken, neither am I, God's going to give you the time you need. Now, you can, make inquiry if this guy's really being overly rude to the diocese and find out what's going on, or like I said, a nearby parish. But please do it, because it's more important that you get to the sacraments than who's giving them to you.
Barry, thanks for that call. Father John Trigilio, thank you for a very speedy hour.
Oh, it was fun.
It's always fun when you're on. May we have your blessing before you go, Father.
Absolutely. Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, Pater, et Filius, et Spiritus Sanctus. Amen.
Amen. Thank you very much, Father John Trigilio. We'll see you on a Thursday in the future, not too long
out.
All right. Tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live, Dr. Stacy Trusenkos will be here. It's Friday the 13th. Is that correct, Nick? Friday the 13th? Your dad was born on Friday the 13th? Holy smoke. She's going to talk about what? She's going to talk about science and faith and why Catholics are not superstitious and not to be superstitious. So if you got a superstitious streak, or if you just want to know why we reject superstition, join us Friday the 13th. Dr. Stacy Trusenkos right here, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.